recorded live.
And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. Fellow Adamites, we are seeing the cracks emerge in Babylon. We are seeing the cracks spread. I don't believe it will be too long now before we hear, Babylon the Great is fallen, is fallen. And Yahweh willing, we shall all be there to witness it, and all the world shall bear witness to the power of Yahweh. If you have not begun to prepare for the things which are to come, the things which we are already starting to see happen, then you had best do so now. Now is the time to make preparations, gather supplies, make plans, and focus your efforts to keep on the straight and narrow path. Be right with the Heavenly Father, and he shall bring you through the plagues that await this doomed nation. Today is May 22nd, 2011, Sunday, and Bill Fink is joining us because the world did not end yesterday, and we're still here today for the show. How are you doing tonight, sir?
Hello, praise Yahweh. And we'll be here to do a show the first Sunday after December 21st, 2012, too, I'm sure.
All right, so when last we left off, we were dealing with how China was not really a loss. China was given away. Nobody lost China. China was handed over to the enemy deliberately.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. Last week we saw that, 2 weeks ago, right? We saw that Al-Jahiz participated in the formation of the policy which turned China over to the communists. And even Suvorov, the Russian historian, right? The Russian historian Suvorov confessed that our agreements with the Soviets virtually handed China over to them as spoils of a war, which they themselves didn't even fight except for 12 days, right? And Al-Jahiz was a key figure in formulating that policy, even though it's denied. I mean, we showed the evidence that it can certainly be asserted that he was also a key figure and helped write the Yalta agreements that turned half of Europe over to the communists. And the communists, as far as I'm concerned, yeah, you know, the communists in the Roosevelt administration, they expended over 418,000 American lives in order to turn most of the world over to the Jewish Bolsheviks, whether they be capitalist or communist. And the Jews have been in complete control of the world ever since.
Absolutely. Not to mention that we didn't need any help from the Soviets to beat the Japanese. The Japanese had already been beaten, and Stalin was in no position to hold anything that he had already taken, all of those ill-gotten gains in Eastern Europe. If we would have told him, you need to go back to your pre-war boundaries, he would have had to say, okay. He had no alternative.
No alternative whatsoever.
He wasn't in a position to dictate.
Except that Roosevelt, yeah, you know, Franklin Roosevelt, we saw here several weeks ago that Franklin Roosevelt was warned on at least three occasions that Al-Jahiz was a communist, and Roosevelt just brushed it off like he didn't care. And that's because Roosevelt was a communist. And his entire, that Roosevelt's and that so many men in the Treasury Department and the State Department working for Franklin Roosevelt, appointed by the Democrats, were all communists and communist agents. Well, that was not a mistake.
I'm sure
it was the communist administration in everything but name.
He knew Al-Jahiz was a communist. Maybe they signed up together at the same time and they went to the same meetings at the Soviet embassy in D.C.
Well, I'm sure they did. Well, now we're up to we've been following this Conservapedia article on Al-Jahiz's life, and we've been, you know, bringing in a lot of information from other sources as we proceed along with it to fortify the article, and we're going to continue in that vein tonight, I believe. And we're up to the part where it discusses Ailes, and Ailes was Al-Jahiz's code name in the Russian, in the KGB, well, I don't know if I could call it the KGB that time. In the Russian intelligence circles, Ailes was Al-Jahiz's code name.
I think at the
there's
time
a lot of
the GRU, wasn't it? The GRU.
Yes, the GRU. There's a lot of dispute coming from the liberal media that Al-Jahiz was Ailes, and the liberal media has been basically running a smokescreen. And what we don't understand, what real Americans and the conservatives, or however you want to term them, don't understand is that when the liberal media defends somebody like Alger Hiss, it's only one communist running cover for another communist. We should hang them both. Well, when the New York Times starts running their mouth about Alger Hiss's possible innocence, when a liberal media outlet starts speaking glowingly of somebody who's suspected and can be proven that they're communist infiltrators, and I'm talking about the 40s, 50s, 60s, we should have known right away, well, now the communists are exposing themselves. Whoever's talking good about Alger Hiss, they're another communist exposing themselves. They get away with it, and in the name of a free press, well, they're basically just communist Jews who are running cover for other members of the same crime ring.
Absolutely. You know, when Hiss died, the New York Times ran an article talking about how he was a persecuted victim of McCarthyism, and they said that his portly, rumpled accuser, Whitaker Chambers, was a one-time Soviet agent.
Well, we have the same problem today, right? What we have a press that speaks glowingly of Barack Obama, Rahm Emanuel, David Axelrod, and all these other commie bastards that have taken over our government. The press has helped put them there. The bankers finance them. It's a one huge crime ring, whether they're liberals, progressives, or neocons. They're all arms of the same crime ring. And the media, they expose themselves as co-conspirators every time they speak glowingly of any of these people.
Absolutely. It's just a communist media running cover for a bunch of communist operatives.
That's all it is. It's like the entire media is the public relations wing of world Judaism. That's all it is.
All right. Would you like to continue in the article?
Ailes, A-L-E-S, that was Alger Hiss's, and there's a ton of evidence that demonstrates this. That was Alger Hiss's code name by which he was referred to in Soviet intelligence circles, the NKVD, the GRU, whatever. After the conference, and this is Conservapedia's article on Alger Hiss, after the conference, Hiss went on to Moscow. The conference is the Yalta conference, right? Where he was honored by Foreign Minister V.M. Molotov. According to Cambridge Professor Christopher Andrew, the Dean of British Historians of Soviet Espionage, Soviet files show that after the Yalta conference, Hiss was secretly awarded the Order of the Red Star during a visit to Moscow. In 2006,
now,
the official...
The Order of the Red Star was established in 1930, and it was awarded to Soviet Red Army personnel for exceptional service in the cause of the defense of the Soviet Union in war or peace. And it had a motto.
And that's exactly what Alger Hiss was doing. He wasn't only defending it, he was helping it grow.
Workers of the World Unite, written on there in Cyrillic, and it said that more than 2 million were awarded during World War I. Mostly to individuals who were Soviet junior officers. They should make that 2 million and one of whom being an American named Alger Hiss.
In 2006, the official newspaper of the Russian Ministry of Defense, Krasnaya Zvezda, Red Star, confirmed that 5 members of a Soviet military intelligence apparatus in Washington, one of whom had been a GRU source in the 30s, well, that's Alger Hiss, and had access to high-level intelligence about U.S. foreign policy, those 5 members received Soviet decorations in February of 1945. That's the month that Yalta was held, right? On April 25th, 1945, Pavel Fitin, head of the NKVD Foreign Intelligence, reported to NKVD Chief Vsevolod Merkulov that Harold Glasser, and let me say that Harold Glasser is a Jew, a Soviet agent in the U.S. Treasury codenamed Ruble, and that's a fitting name for a Treasury officer, right? Learned of this award from his friend Ailes, a GRU agent, that would be Alger Hiss. According to data from Vadim, a group of agents in the military, which in the military neighbors, that's their reference to the GRU, right? They're called the military neighbors.
NKVD chief Vasilvayed Merkulev, he was born in Azerbaijan. So
yeah,
you have to wonder, was he actually Russian?
Yeah, he wasn't. He wasn't too Russian. According to data from Vadim, the group of Vadim is Gorsky. That's a code name for Gorsky. According to data from Vadim, the group of agents of the military neighbors, that's a code name for the GRU, whose part Rubel was earlier recently, was decorated with orders of the USSR. Rubel learned, and this is Harold Glasser, Rubel learned about this fact from his friend Ailes, who is the head of the mentioned group. This memo apparently refers to Venona Decrypt, and I'll explain what Venona is in a minute. Number 1822, dated March 30th, 1945, in which Vadim, which is the code name for Anatoly Gorsky, the chief of Soviet intelligence in the U.S., Vadim reports, following up on a conversation with Ailes, that Ailes has been continuously working with the neighbors, or the GRU, since 1935. Now that's right around the time he was in that agricultural agricultural adjustment agency, which was a hotbed of communism in the Roosevelt administration.
The Boy Scouts, communist, basically, wasn't it? It was where you got your start.
Yeah, it was a launching pad for American communists to get into the Roosevelt government. That they started there, and they moved on to the Treasury Department, to the State Department. Since 1935, but for a few years now, he has been the director of a small group of probationers or agents of the neighbors, or GRU, for the most part drawn from his relatives, his wife and brother were fellow Communist Party members, that recently Ailes and his whole group were awarded Soviet medals, and that after the Yalta Conference back in Moscow, one very high-ranking Soviet worker allegedly had contact with Ailes. Ailes implied that it was Comrade Vyshinsky, and at the request of the military neighbors, he conveyed to him their thanks. Regarding Ailes, one FBI memo reports, and the FBI knew that Alger Hiss was a Soviet agent and a communist long before Yalta, and they reported it to Roosevelt. They didn't act on it. I mean, I don't know what would stop him from just locking them up, but they didn't act on it. They reported it to Roosevelt, and he just laughed them off. The FBI report says that, this FBI memo says, it would appear likely that this individual, meaning Ailes, is Alger Hiss, in view of the fact that he was in the State Department, and the information from Chambers indicated that his wife, Priscilla, was active in Soviet espionage, and he also had a brother, Donald, in the State Department. It is also to be noted that Hiss did attend Yalta, the Yalta Conference, as a special advisor to President Roosevelt, and he would, of course, have conferred with high officials of other nations attending the conference. That the American communists to this very day attempt to claim that the Soviet spy, Ailes, was not Alger Hiss. And doing this, they merely continue the lies which attempt to cover for Hiss and by extension for themselves. It is unanimous, in its unanimous final report in 1997, the bipartisan Moynihan Commission on Government Secrecy agreed regarding Ailes, that this spy mentioned in the Venona documents, that this could only be Alger Hiss. Let me explain what the Venona documents are, right? That there's a group of papers that are called the Venona files. And the Venona files are decoded cables sent from Soviet agents in the United States to Moscow that were actually intercepted. Every once in a while, the government does something right? That they don't always screw up. Transcripts of the intercepted cables were released by the CIA and by the NSA in 1995 and 1996. The Venona transcript with the most relevance to the Hiss case is number 1822. I guess all of these cables as they were intercepted and translated, that they were all numbered, right? Number 1822 was sent on March 30th, 1945, from the Soviet's Washington station chief to Moscow. And I have a copy of the transcript here, And I'll try to remember to include this when I post this program. If one accepts that Ailes is indeed Alger Hiss, the transcript indicates that Hiss continued to work as a Soviet agent until at least 1945, and we can understand that he worked as a communist agent and as a pro-communist government official after that, long after that. Well after his association with Chambers, Whitaker Chambers, had ended in 1938, was Hiss still working as a Soviet agent. The period of the 1940s was one during which Hiss served as an important policymaker in the State Department. As we've seen, he helped set the China policy. He helped write the Yalta documents, which just handed Europe over to the communists. This Venona transcript number 1822 is very it's very incriminating. And let me say, and I'll probably read this again in my notes, that the that there is a lot of testimony that was given linking by Russians, by Russian historians, and by Russians and American spies that had made statements later in the late 40s, in the 1950s, and by Russians who defected as late as the 1980s. There were many statements, and we'll see some of them here tonight, that linked Alger Hiss to the codename Ailes, and these people linked Alger Hiss to this codename Ailes used by Soviet intelligence authorities long before the Venona transcripts were made public, well, which gives them all – it gives those people that made the identification – since Venona hadn't been made public yet, it gives them all the more credibility, right? That the in this transcript, this Venona transcript number 1822, Ailes is assumed by most scholars to be Alger Hiss. The conclusion is suggested by point number 6 in the transcript, which refers to Ailes visiting Moscow after the 1945 Yalta Conference, and we know that Alger Hiss did that. Hiss attended Yalta, and he attended it as an advisor, actually, to Secretary of State Stettinius. And he traveled with Stettinius to Moscow after Yalta by private plane. Also, Hiss was identified as Ailes in 1988, and this is one instance, by Oleg Gordievsky, 8 years before this transcript was made public. And Gordievsky was a high-ranking KGB agent who defected to the West in 1985. Gordievsky wrote that a handful of the most important agents were run individually and not through spy networks, in other words, directly by the Soviets. Among them was Alger Hiss, and Gordievsky associated told us that his code name was Ailes, and his wartime controller was the leading NKVD illegal agent in the United States, called, and his name was Ishak Abdulovich Akhmarov, and he doesn't sound too Russian, does he?
Could be one of those Russians from the Crimea.
This reference to Hiss as Ailes occurs more than 6 years before the release of the Venona transcript. And this Venona transcript, 1822, are references to the GRU. There's references in here to Alger Hiss's wife, Priscilla, to his brother, Donald, to the State Department. And there's a reference to Nathan Silvermaster. Nathan Silvermaster, and he's not exactly an Englishman, right?
He's German?
I don't think he's German either. He was the head of a major Soviet espionage ring in the United States government. And that's just one. You know, we have the Silvermaster. So far in this discussion, in this series, we've seen identified a spy group under Nathan Silvermaster. We've seen a spy group under Ware, under Perlow, under Wheel, and there's a multitude of different spy groups operating in Washington. It's incredible. Now there are also in this Venona transcript 82 there's a reference to Anatoly Gromov, the Washington station chief. He sent it and to Comrade Vyshinky and to the Yalta Conference directly. So this is very incriminating.
With Rose from the White House, how many spy rings do they need?
Well, right, exactly. But I think that they needed the spy rings not to watch the White House. They needed the spy rings to watch all of the actual Americans that were in the various governmental departments. I mean, the Jews didn't supplant everybody there were a lot of civil servants and a lot of other elected officials that, I mean, Roosevelt didn't replace them all with communists in 1932, right? Well, it's very clear to me the entire government was certainly undermined by Roosevelt's appointees, who all happened, a great majority of them seemed to be Jews and communists. And it's unanimous, and this is concerning this Venona transcript that I just tried to describe, and it's unanimous final report in 1997. The bipartisan Moynihan Commission on Government Secrecy agreed regarding Ailes. This could only be Alger Hiss, was its statement. Analysts at the NSA have also gone on record that Ailes could only have been Alger Hiss. The late U.S. Air Force historian Edward Mark called the FBI and the NSA's conclusions eminently reasonable, writing that the evidence showed that Ailes was very probably Alger Hiss. Well, Edward Mark, he just doesn't sound too much like a Saxon either. John R. Schindler, professor of strategy at the Naval War College and himself a former NSA analyst, agrees, calling this identification exceptionally solid and the evidence compelling. John Ehrman of the CIA's Directorate of Intelligence concurs. It is clear that Hiss alone remains the best candidate to be Ailes. Christopher Andrew, writing with ex-KGB agent Vasily Mitrokhin, says that the identification of Ailes as Hiss is beyond reasonable doubt. The codename Ailes, concludes Mark Kramer, director of the Project for Cold War Studies at Harvard University, seems to fit only Hiss. So we even see people on the left admitting that Ailes is Hiss. The only people that still deny it are the communists in the media. And I've seen denials. In researching for this series, I've seen such denials in outlets such as the New York Times and articles on their website. It's incredible, with all the evidence that they're still trying to run cover for Alger Hiss.
Even when they catch spies, they pretty much just let them go. Like that Russian spy ring, those communists they just captured in the New York metro area last year, that Anna Chapman, you know, the one that they're saying, oh, she's a sexy Russian spy. They deported her to Russia after charging her with conspiracy to act as an unlawful agent of a foreign government. Is that what we do when we catch a spy red-handed?
The Jews want to give our country away, and it's... And every once in a while, they make an example of somebody, and Pollard, Jonathan Pollard, the Jew, is an example for some reason or other, but the greater number of foreign nationals caught spying in the United States, and that includes Russians and Chinese, are just slapped on the wrist. It's incredible.
I wonder what would happen if you're an Iranian caught spying in Israel.
I don't think you have much of a future there. Well, one thing the communists in America cannot possibly recognize or admit to is this, and it's too bad that most so-called conservatives also miss it. The outcome of World War II and subsequent events was so tilted in favor of the communists that it could never have happened unless it was actually orchestrated by communists working within the U.S. government. If Hiss was not a communist, if Roosevelt's other advisors, Harry Hopkins, Edward Stettinius, Avril Harriman, Charles E. Bolin, Harry Dexter White, were not communists, or at least overly sympathetic to communists, and they certainly were. It can be demonstrated that Avril Harriman and Charles Bolin didn't. They like to label Bolin in academia as nonpartisan. This guy was so sympathetic to communist Russia, it seemed like he had a stake in the Bolshevik Revolution. And if they weren't so sympathetic or actual communists themselves, then how did these things happen? How did we just give half the world away to communist Russia after we won the Second World War? We didn't win the Second World War. The Jews did, and they wanted Bolshevik Russia to have all those things.
We won it for them.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. America had by far the upper hand in militarily in Europe and in Asia. How is it that we simply handed over all those nations, Romania, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia? How did we just hand them all over to the communists?
Well, you know, they had to be punished for what they tried in the 1920s.
Well, right. It had to be the treachery was involved. It had to be. The communist media and communist academia in this country have been making excuses ever since, and most Americans to this day still fall for it, deceived by the idea that there should even actually be a debate. There shouldn't even be a debate. It's incredible that the Roosevelt administration itself represented a Jewish communist takeover of America. There's no doubt. Here at Yalta, I'm going to quote Senator Joseph McCarthy on September 23rd, 1950. He said, "Here at Yalta was signed a death warrant of the young men who are dying today in the hills and valleys of Korea. Here was signed a death warrant of the young men who will die tomorrow in the jungles of Indochina." And he was certainly correct. Back to Conservapedia. On March 24th, FBI agent E.A. Tam, this is March 24th, 1945, okay? FBI agent E.A. Tam, assistant to FBI Director A. Edgar Hoover, alerted Robert Lynch, special assistant to the Secretary of State, to Chambers' allegations that Hiss had been a member of the underground organization of the Communist Party and to Hiss's links to Nathan Witt and Lee Pressman. After interviewing Hiss the next day, FBI official D.M. Ladd furnished Frederick B. Lyon, the chief of the State Department Division of Foreign Activity Correlation, a summary memorandum outlining this information. On March 26th, State Department Security Officer Robert Bannerman sent Donald Russell, Assistant Secretary of State for Administration, a comprehensive secret report on Chambers' allegations regarding Hiss, recommending that, quote, immediate action be taken to terminate Mr. Hiss's services with the State Department. This is 1945. This is a month after Yalta, right? It's just incredible that nothing was done here, and nothing was done until the 1950s.
Well, maybe Hoover was busy investigating the mob, you know, the same mob that didn't exist.
Now Nathan Witt, as we see the FBI identifying Hiss with Nathan Witt here, Nathan Witt was hired by the Agricultural Adjustment Administration in the early 1930s. He worked at the National Labor Relations Board, was a member of the Communist Party in the United States, the U.S. affiliate of the Global Moscow-directed Comintern organization, whose stated aim was world revolution, by all means, including armed force, the overthrow of the international bourgeois, and the creation of an international Soviet republic as a transition stage to complete abolition of the state, which is what the Jews want, right? I mean, that's the Communist Manifesto, the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, all those documents that the Jews have left a huge trail of crimes across, around the world now, and nobody seems to want to believe that those documents even exist. It's incredible. That the average white Christian just rejects all that because the Jews are what? God's chosen people. It's that they take, they're worshiping Satan is what they're doing. Now Lee Pressman is also he's also a longtime communist who got his start in the same place, the Agricultural Adjustment Administration. That was the launch pad for American communists to get into the Roosevelt administration.
They should have just called it the People's Commissariat of Agriculture.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. Okay, now we're going to turn our attention. Now we understand that there's no doubt that it's ridiculous to doubt that Ailes, that the Soviet spy, the American spy for the Soviets, codenamed Ailes, is Alger Hiss. It should be without doubt. It fits like a glove. That's the only description I have for it. It fits like every aspect, every mention of ales in Soviet intelligence bulletins line right up with Alger Hiss's actions and the circumstances of his life and the circumstances of his office.
Who do the liberals suggest that Ailes was? Do they have an alternative suggestion?
Yeah, you know, they had an alternative suggestion. I read it early in my research for this series, and it was ludicrous, but I don't exactly remember who it was. But it was ludicrous. It was somebody that didn't fit the description at all. That they just picked a random Saxon. Yeah, you know, they picked a random white guy. They picked his name out of a hat.
So Ailes, farmer in Iowa.
Well, no, he was a member of the State Department, but it was the identification was ludicrous. The United Nations. Now, this man had brought us communist China and communist Eastern Europe, also brought us the United Nations. Even as the Soviets were decorating Ailes, and as the FBI was telling the people in the State Department that he was a spy, right? Hiss was promoted to become director of the State Department Office of Special Political Affairs. Shortly thereafter, he was named Secretary General of the upcoming United Nations Charter Conference in San Francisco. We will see that was a decision made at Yalta, okay, by Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin, by the three of them, that Alger Hiss would have this position in the United Nations. He was made Secretary General, and as Secretary General managing the agenda, shortly thereafter he was named Secretary General of the upcoming United Nations Charter Conference in San Francisco. As Secretary General managing the agenda, reported Time magazine, Hiss will, quote, have a lot to say behind the scenes about who gets the breaks. Well, that's an understatement, right? I have here the actual Time magazine article, okay? This article ran in Time magazine Monday, April 16th, 1945. That's about 3 weeks after the FBI already exposed him as a spy, right?
And they say he was one of the State Department's brighter young men.
Yeah, right. The Secretary General, I'm quoting that Time magazine article, this is April 16, 1945. The Secretary General for the San Francisco Conference was named at Yalta, but announced only last week. Lanky, Harvard-trained Alger Hiss, one of the State Department's brighter young men. Alger Hiss was one of the Harvard Law School students whose records earned them the favor of Professor, now Justice, Supreme Court Justice, Felix Frankfurter, and he was a communist agent, right? He had to be. He introduced all these communists into government. And a year as secretary to the late Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes. He was drafted from a New York law firm by the New Deal in 1933. No, he was drafted by Felix Frankfurter, recommending him to Franklin Roosevelt because he was a communist. And Felix Frankfurter was also a communist.
Well, does it matter if Frankfurter was a communist? He was a Jew. It's the same thing.
Well, yeah, right. It is the same thing. That's what our people just simply don't get. He joined the State Department in 1936, and he accompanied President Roosevelt to Yalta. So I guess he didn't do too much between 36 and 45, right? At San Francisco, he and his secretariat of 300, mostly Americans, will have the drudging, thankless clerk's job of copying, translating, and publishing, running the thousands of paperclip and pencil chores of an international meeting. That this, I know the language is very choppy, but that's the language of the Time magazine article.
Oh, and but I just wanted to say, Felix Frankfurter, he got his start thanks to Jacob Schiff. And of course, you know who Jacob Schiff is, of Kuhn Loeb Company. Jacob,
well, of course,
gave the money he needed.
Goes back. So for every one of them, you're going to find somebody more treacherous, right, lurking in the shadows behind them, right, that gave him his start. But Alger Hiss will be an important figure there. As Secretary General managing the agenda, he will have a lot to say behind the scenes about who gets the breaks. He'll also have a lot more than that because he wrote the charter to the United Nations. The United Nations was basically a communist organization from its inception. What I'm going to read next is what the United Nations doesn't want you to know. And it's an article by a gentleman named Irvin Baxter Jr. He's a Christian. He doesn't really reveal that until the end of the article, but he's a Christian writing from an apocalyptic Christian perspective, and I'm not going to go that far in the article, but I'm going to read the first couple of paragraphs. A young American diplomat was the leading force in the designing of the United Nations. He was the secretary of the Dumbarton Oaks Conversations from August to October of 1944, where most of the preliminary planning for the United Nations was done. I would say the rest of them were probably rabbis. He was Roosevelt's right-hand man in February of 1945 at Yalta, where the post-war boundaries of Europe were drawn. Roosevelt was a dying man at the time. His death came only 10 weeks later. At Yalta, it was agreed that the Soviet Union would have three votes, one each for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarusia, in the United Nations General Assembly, even though the United Nations had only one. Even though the United States had only one. At Yalta, much of Europe was placed under the iron heel of communist rule. At Yalta, Churchill, Roosevelt, and Stalin appointed this young diplomatic shining star to be the first Secretary General of the UN for the founding conference held in San Francisco, April to June of 1945. All of this seemed well and good until 3 years later. Alger Hiss was exposed as a communist spy and sent to prison. Only then did people understand why the emblem of the United Nations looked so much like the emblem of the Soviet Union. And I'm sorry, I said it was the early 50s. It was 1948. It now made sense that the Soviet Union at Yalta was given control over all of Eastern Europe. Then everyone understood how the Soviet Union managed to capture three votes in the UN General Assembly compared to one for the United States. Sure, it was rigged by communists. It was a communist organization from the beginning. Then it became clear why a secret deal had been struck stating that a communist would always hold the office of the head of the UN military. And if you look, and there's a list provided with this article, and if you look, you will see that a communist always did hold the position of head of the United Nations military. The UN Charter was authored by a communist. The first UN Secretary General was a communist, and the UN, from the beginning, was designed to be a union of world socialist republics. So we may as well add an S and an R to USA, right? On a recent tour of the UN, not one mention was made of this by any tour guide. Hiss's name was not mentioned one time. When pictures of the founding conference contained his picture, our UN guide avoided telling us who it was. I'm sure everyone was taught about the United Nations and its importance in school, but I'm also sure that the above information was conveniently omitted from your textbooks, and it certainly was. We generally do not see Alger Hiss's name mentioned together with United Nations history. Even as the Soviets,
I never heard about it. In fact, I don't think anybody ever spoke about Alger Hiss. Although, if I recall, we did an entire unit on McCarthyism and the Inquisition. They tied the two in together, and they talked about modern day witch hunts and how they tried to string out to dry nice people such as Alger Hiss on bogus charges and political vendettas.
Yeah, well, that's history from the perspective of the victors, right? The Jews won the war, so they get to write the history. We're just the cannon fodder, basically. Okay, on March 19th, Wild Bill Donovan, this is 1945 still, director of the Office of Strategic Services, precursor of the CIA, offered Stettinius, who was the Secretary of State at the time, the services of OSS foreign experts to prepare research studies on all personnel concerned in that first United Nations conference. Alger Hiss strongly opposed this proposal. Of course, because he wanted to rig the whole payroll with communists, and vigorously endorsed the view that the OSS doing espionage work at the conference would seriously embarrass us, typical liberal line. As a result, American intelligence work at the conference was sharply limited. Meanwhile, Anatoly Gorsky, the chief of Soviet intelligence in the U.S., wanted to meet with Ailes, Alger Hiss, at the conference, according to a cable Vasiliev discovered in the Soviet archives. His notes indicate that Ailes had worked with Rubel, Harold Glasser, another Jewish-American communist, as a member of the group run by Whitaker Chambers. The cable adds that Glasser gives Hiss an exceptionally good political reference as a member of the Communist Party, completely aware that he is a communist in an illegal position with all the ensuing consequences, and recommends, according to the notes, that he be approached at the UN conference by Sergei, which is the NKD agent Vladimir Provdin, then undercover as New York bureau chief of the Soviet news agency TASS.
Well, why would we allow a Soviet news agency in this country? I have to wonder, did the Soviet Union allow American news agencies?
Well, I'm sure there weren't too many reporting and taking pictures in the
gulags of Siberia.
or in the reign of terror that accompanied the initial coup by Lenin and Trotsky, right?
I'm sure they were allowed to be there for party functions and party congresses and see how the elite lived, but they weren't allowed to go out into the collective farms and interview farmers who were miserable.
Well, 20 million dying Ukrainians. I never saw too many pictures.
Well, that didn't happen. Weren't you paying attention in history class?
In April of 1945, at the UN conference, Glasser slipped Gorsky a warning that the FBI had notified Stettinius that Bureau surveillance had followed a bundle of State Department documents from Washington to New York, where they were photographed, then returned within 24 hours to Washington. Only three people had access to these documents, one of whom was Alger Hiss. Stettinius told Hiss, "I hope it is not you." After the conference, Stettinius resigned to become the first U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. His successor as Secretary of State, James Burns, was immediately faced with the problem of what he would do with Alger Hiss. Burns had been pushed out of planning the UN conference, according to Stettinius, after FDR had signaled that Alger Hiss and I should handle this entirely ourselves, making sure the world was safe for communists. Burns said that despite his categorical instructions not to recommend any U.S. citizen for posts in the U.N. Secretariat, Hiss forwarded to the U.N. resumes of nearly 500 people, many of them his confreres at the state, and I'm sure that they were all communists, as prospective global staffers. So Hiss he was told by his boss, because Burns is technically his boss, even though Roosevelt's the president, right? Burns is the Secretary of State. He was told by his boss not to recommend any U.S. citizen for posts in the United Nations, and Hiss just blew him off and put in 500 resumes, right?
Wasn't FDR dead at that point? He died in the second week of April of 45.
Okay, well, FDR is not quite dead at this point, because this is
this must have been
This is April of 1945. But
he died
in
April 12. This must have been one of the last things he did then.
Must be, because in the context of this narrative, FDR is still alive. He signaled to according to Stettinius, after FDR had signaled that Alger Hiss and I should handle this entirely ourselves. So FDR must have still been in his last days, right?
So he's at death's door, and he's still doing everything he can to advance the communist agenda.
Well, it's absolutely clear to me that's what's going on here. And Hiss just blew his boss off. He blew Burns off and put in 500 resumes anyway. And I'm sure that there weren't a whole lot of Republicans or conservatives or and those 500 resumes, right?
They're probably all communist Jews.
Of course. Many, and this is talking about the 500, many were members of communist cells in the government whose jobs were at risk under a tightened security program, that they were fleeing for a bigger government, right, or supposedly. The communist Dalton Trumbo, a thoroughgoing Stalinist, boasted that he had been Stettinius's ghostwriter at the conference, and I'm sure Hiss hired him, right? Press accounts attributed the hiring of Trumbo, here it is, who would become infamous in 1947 as one of the Hollywood Ten. Press accounts attributed his hiring to Alger Hiss. So you can't write a script better than this in favor of the communists. You can't. You really can't. That this can't be planned any better. That the United Nations would be entirely staffed by American communists ceding our sovereignty to communists overseas, basically. Hoping to obtain control of the entire Mediterranean, the Soviets forced through a UN resolution demanding an immediate boycott of Spain. And we really see that as payback for Franco's prevention for Franco's interference in Spain falling into communist hands, right? But as it gradually became clear that the Soviets were seeking communist expansion worldwide, the U.S. sought the reversal of this UN resolution. According to William B. Dunham of the State Department's Office of Western European Affairs, quote, "In the State Department, many, especially in the Bureau of UN Affairs, took every opportunity, tried every dodge to oppose or at least obstruct as best they could, reversing the UN resolution. Deputy Assistant Secretary for UN Affairs Alger Hiss led the obstructionists there." I think in this case, Alger Hiss is giving an inch in order that he could take a mile. That the there's still a lot of good people in the State Department and in the civil service in the government. They're not all communists, but it seems that all of Roosevelt's top advisors, all of those people that were closest to him, and all of the people that were appointed in the most influential positions after the war and towards the end of the war were definitely communists. Harry Hopkins, they were all very sympathetic to the Soviets, and they're the people that Roosevelt used in order to forward the communist agenda worldwide. According to a State Department internal security probe of Hiss, ordered by Burns, who's now the Secretary of State, right? This probe was made public in 1993, 50 years later almost. In February 1945, Hiss requested top secret files from the OSS on the British, Soviet, French, and Chinese internal security policies, as well as Far East policy. So he's getting awfully bold at this time, right? And this is February 1945, so Roosevelt's still not dead yet. It's just after Yalta.
So here they are deciding just what they can hand over to the Soviet Union. I'm surprised they didn't decide to hand over Argentina and Brazil.
Right. FBI and Mexico. FBI surveillance at this time found that Hiss also developed a keen interest in atomic energy and other matters relating to military intelligence, all of which was well outside the purview of his office. This finding was congruent with a Venona cable date the following month in which Gorsky reported that Ailes and his group were working on obtaining military information since Soviet military intelligence allegedly are not very interested in materials about the bank, the United States Department of State. Lloyd Henderson, director of the State Department Office of Near East Affairs, quietly ordered members of the NEA, the Department of Near East Affairs, to keep confidential materials and information away from Hiss. On June 26, 1945, now Harry Truman's president, right? The UN Charter was signed in San Francisco. 2 days later, State Department liaison Lieutenant Andrew Roth of the Office of Naval Intelligence was arrested in the Amerasia spy case. Communist Party Secretary General Communist Party General Secretary Eugene Dennis told CPUSA National Committee member Jack Stosch that Roth suggested that Alger Hiss might be used to quash the case against Roth. According to former CPUSA Politburo member Louis Budenz, that this Andrew Roth was he was the chief researcher for the Institute of Pacific Relations publication Amerasia. He was a KGB operative. It seems like he was a Jew, right? And served in the Office of Naval Intelligence during World War II. When Roth entered the U.S. Navy, some question had been raised because he was reported to be a communist. Here's the good one. But naval intelligence held that, quote, the fact that the man was a communist was not a bar since we were at peace with Russia. Roth was given a lieutenant's commission and assigned to naval intelligence as a liaison officer between the Navy and the U.S. State Department. So I don't get this. And ever since Bolshevism was established in Russia, it was a professed goal that Bolshevism in Russia would spread itself over the entire world. How did Americans miss that one? So anybody that's sympathetic to the Soviets has to be in agreement with the Soviet world. How did they miss that one?
Or their worldview was tainted by the Jews. What was it that Mr. Finley wrote? The foregoing report will indicate the extremely critical nature of the present situation. The danger is now so great that I feel it my duty to call the attention of the British and all other governments to the fact that if an end is not put to Bolshevism in Russia at once, the civilization of the whole world will be threatened. I consider that the immediate suppression of Bolshevism is the greatest issue now before the world, not even excluding the war, which is still raging. And unless, as stated above, Bolshevism is nipped in the bud immediately, it is bound to spread in one form or another over Europe and the whole world as it is organized and worked by Jews who have no nationality and whose one object is to destroy for their own ends the existing order of things.
Well, it seems to me that anybody that should have known anything about Russia in government and in naval intelligence and any of the intelligence services should have known that their intent was to make the entire world communist, that a professed communist could not be compatible with the goals of any free nation and the aspirations to freedom that any free nation should naturally have. You can't be a patriotic American and be a communist in the 1930s or 40s. And they just overlooked that because technically we were not at war with Russia. That's just incredible. Because Russia was, when the Bolsheviks took over in Russia, all of their statements proved that they were at war with everybody. And they still are to this day. And we've lost because we haven't recognized the enemy.
Absolutely, and I'm sure the New York Times didn't run any specials on Russia number one, did they?
No, absolutely not. But those it was known by enough people what had happened in the Ukraine and what had happened in Stalin's reign of terror and what had happened even earlier than that in the initial Bolshevik takeover and the wars between the various Jewish groups for control of the nation and the White Army, and that was, for the most part, anybody that read anything should have known most of that. That something was up there, and they should have been able to discern the communist intentions. I don't understand it. Maybe I'm just not giving the Jews enough credit. Igor Guzenko. On September 5th, 1945, GRU code clerk Igor Guzenko defected from the Soviet embassy in Ottawa, telling the Royal Canadian Mounted Police that one Lieutenant Kulikov in the Office of Soviet military attaché told him that he learned in Moscow prior to his departure in May 1945 that an assistant to then U.S. Secretary of State Stettinius was a Soviet spy. Stettinius' aide at the time was Alger Hiss. 2 days later, Canadian Prime Minister William Lyon Mackenzie King wrote that acting Under Secretary of State for External Affairs Norman Robertson told him that Gruzenko's documents disclosed that everything was much worse than we would have believed. Stettinius had been surrounded by spies, etc., and that the Russian government had been kept informed of all that was being done from that source, the Department of State. I wonder if Stettinius really surrounded himself with spies accidentally. It seemed to be that there were so many people under the Secretary of State in the Roosevelt administration who were sympathetic to Russia or outright communists that I don't know how that could be an accident.
That same day,
Soviet UN Ambassador Andrei Gromyko in London told Stettinius, now the new U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, that he would be very happy to see Alger Hiss appointed temporary secretary general and thus a candidate for the first permanent secretary general of the United Nations. Gromyko was reiterating a suggestion he had made at the San Francisco conference the previous April. Also that day, Hiss made an extraordinary proposal that the State Department create a new post, that of Special Assistant for Military Affairs, linked to his Office of Special Political Affairs, thus giving Hiss access to information regarding atomic energy, arms procurement, and military intelligence. So Hiss is making a political play so that he could pass more information to the communists. Hiss also proposed the State Department reorganization scheme under which, wrote Panic, Hiss would acquire working control over the flow of papers within the department. If this ambitious project should be approved, warned Panic, the Hiss group will have achieved infiltration in or control of what he identified as critically strategic points within the State Department. Following up on Gruzenko's revelations, and that he probably needed, his probably needed to make these plays because of the death of Roosevelt, and I mean this is conjecture on my part, but because of the death of Roosevelt, he would be taken out of the loop on a lot of things, not having the same relationship with Truman. Following up on Gruzenko's revelations, Raymond Murphy of the State Department again interviewed Chambers, Whitaker Chambers, who repeated that Hiss's assignment was to mess up policy. On September 25th, Walter Winchell, who was a Jew, right, again broached the subject on his broadcast, reporting, "It can be categorically stated that the question of the loyalty and integrity of one high American official has been called to the attention of the president." Not exactly revelatory. We previously saw evidence that there were at least three occasions prior to Yalta that Roosevelt was warned about Hiss and he laughed them all off. Elizabeth Bentley. In November 1945, Father Charles F. Cronin, a priest instructed by the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops to prepare a study on the spread of communism in the United States, reported, "In the State Department, the most influential communist has been Alger Hiss." Let me note that Father Cronin is from the same clan as my grandmother, right? On November 27th, the FBI disseminated a secret report to the State Department, the Attorney General, and the Truman White House, reporting Chambers' identification of Hiss as a secret member of the communist underground apparatus in contact with the Ware Group.
And I'm wondering, what did they say? Tell us something we don't already know?
Yeah, right. 3 days later, defecting Soviet courier Elizabeth Bentley advised FBI investigators that Victor Perlow, and he was another spy ring head in Washington, told her that Harold Glasser had been taken away from the Perlow group and turned over to a Russian by some American in some governmental agency in Washington. So Harold Glasser was, his skills and talents were transferred, I guess. Bentley's unlikely account was corroborated by the previously cited April 25th, 1945 memo from Pavel Fitin, head of the NKVD Foreign Intelligence, to NKVD Chief Vsevolod Mertsyalov, noting that Glasser had worked for both the NKVD and the GRU. It said, "Our agent Rubel, drawn to work for the Soviet Union in May 1937, passed initially through the military neighbors, that's the GRU, and then through our station, NKVD, valuable information on political and economic issues." Bentley said that Charles Kramer, who would be identified by both Lee Pressman and Nathaniel Weil as a member of the Ware Group, and let me say that Charles Kramer was originally born Charles Krivitsky, and he was an economist.
He must have been Irish.
Well, right. I don't think he's too Irish. He worked for the Office of Price Administration during the war.
So a central committee that set prices.
And in 1944, he worked for the Democratic National Committee. And in 1946, to assist the reelection campaign of California Democratic Representative Ellis Patterson, who was also a communist. Kramer also worked for the United States Senate Subcommittee on War Mobilization and the Senate Subcommittee on Wartime Health and Education, and the Senate Labor and Public Welfare Committee after the war. Kramer provided information to the Soviets from his position as staff member of the Senate Subcommittee on War Mobilization on a dispute among American policymakers concerning the Comité National Français, or Free French National Committee of Charles de Gaulle, and an internal U.S. government investigation of German corporate links to American companies. Kramer also passed information from the Democratic National Committee about President Truman's likely appointments in the State Department and views of Truman by various senators. Spies all over Washington. It's incredible. Bentley said that Charles Kramer told her that the person who had done this was named Hiss and that he was in the U.S. State Department. She said after Jack, Soviet agent Joseph Katz, after Jack asked her who Hiss was, she clipped an article in which Hiss was mentioned from the New York Daily PM, the name of the magazine, whose Washington correspondent, I.F. Stone, was a fellow traveler, a communist in the media, imagine that, who cooperated with Soviet intelligence as an agent of influence. Bentley said, "It is my present recollection that this newspaper article stated Hiss's full name was Eugene," and that's the mistake she made, "Eugene Hiss, and that he was an advisor to Dean Acheson in the State Department. FBI investigation quickly closed in on Alger Hiss. This was consistent with the above-cited March 5, 1945 cable in which Gorsky reported that Ailes, Alger Hiss, and Rubel, Harold Glasser, used to work in Carl's informational group, which was affiliated with the neighbors." So that informational group is the group of Whitaker Chambers. His code word in Soviet intelligence circles was Carl. Before the end of 1945, a State Department security memorandum summarized, quote, "Bentley advised that members of this group had told her that Hiss of the State Department had taken Harold Glasser of the Treasury Department and two or three others and turned them over to direct control by the Soviet representatives in this country. In this regard, attention is directed to Whitaker Chambers' statement regarding Alger Hiss and to the statement by Guzenko regarding an assistant to the Secretary of State who was a Soviet agent." So there's just all kinds of Without the Venona, without the Venona transcripts, without Whitaker Chambers even, there is all kinds of evidence that Alger Hiss was indeed a direct Soviet spy.
Well, I mean, what, do we need to hear it directly from his mouth for people to believe the evidence?
And he died in 1996. He was still denying it, right?
And I'm sure that we've met the civil burden, preponderance of the facts, and we've met the criminal burden beyond all reasonable doubt. There's no doubt in my mind that he was a communist agent.
Well, right. And like I tried to explain before, that it's ridiculous to think that we would hand over so many nations, free nations, to Soviet control and just let them take those nations when we had the military upper hand. We would just hand over half the world to Soviet control by chance or by accident or because we had no choice. All of that was a lie. I know that the Jewish communist media in this country likes to make us think that that was the cost of freedom and we had no choice but to do that, but that's all a lie. They're just running cover for the Roosevelt crime ring. They're just running cover for them. It's ridiculous. It's absurd that people believe it and they still buy this garbage.
In 100 years, they might even just erase the name Alger Hiss from the textbooks.
Well, they'd like to erase the names of all their drones from the textbooks so that we don't know what happened to our history, so that we don't know how the decline of our nation came to be. On February 9th, 1946, Stalin declared that war was inevitable as long as capitalism existed. In a speech regarded by some as as the open declaration of the Cold War, 2 days later, ex-communist Benjamin Mandel, how could a Jew be an ex-communist is beyond me, former manager of the Daily Worker, identified Alger Hiss to the FBI as a Communist Party member and one of a high-level group of government employees who would not be found openly connected with the party or with any front organizations, and who were specifically instructed not to display such connections. The Bureau again interviewed Hiss, who denied ever being a communist and denied knowledge of any of his friends being communists. Well, I don't know how he got by his wife and his brother, right? He said none of his friends were communists. He did, however, add that he had heard it said that Lee Pressman was either a party member or followed the party line. So right here he throws Lee Pressman under the bus, hoping to divert attention from himself, right?
Isn't that what they always do? They throw a little one under the bus to divert attention away from a dozen others.
Right. Secretary of State Burns took seriously warnings from the State Department Security and the FBI that evidence existed suggesting that Hiss might be a security risk. That's incredible. There are red lights going off and bells and whistles all over the place, right? And they still let this guy operate. By that spring, Burns was persuaded that Hiss was working for the Communist Party. Like, what's the secret? An FBI memo of March 14th relates a report that Burns stated that Hiss is to be given no further consideration for promotion or assignment to responsible duties in the department, and that he wanted to know whether Hiss could be dismissed summarily, adding, Secretary Burns is of the definite opinion that Alger Hiss should be disposed of. On May 15th, the State Department prepared a top-secret chart identifying 124 loyalty or security cases under department payroll. And the media loves to call Joe McCarthy what? A whistleblower? McCarthyism? What? A headhunter? They got all kinds of epithets for him. And McCarthy was right. McCarthy was right, but he was 10 years too late. There were 124 loyalty or security cases on the State Department payroll broken down into categories, 77 suspects, another 13 communists, an additional 14 sympathizers, and most ominously, a further 20 personnel identified as agents, one of whom was Alger Hiss. 2 weeks later, FBI Special Agent Mickey Ladd reported to Director Hoover that Panuk reported to the Bureau that Alger Hiss was part of an enormous espionage ring in Washington working for the Soviets, right out of FDR's office. On July 26, Secretary of State Burns wrote to Congressman Adolph J. Sabath, S-A-B-A-T-H, I don't think he's German, that security screeners had identified 284 State Department employees as unfit for permanent employment. He added that 79 of these had since left the department, leaving 205 still on the payroll. On August 3rd, State Department official Samuel Klaus prepared a 106-page confidential memo summarizing security data in each of the cases listed on the May 15th chart. That year, British intelligence supplied its order of battle against Soviet-led guerrillas in Greece through the Pentagon. Shortly thereafter, this top-secret information appeared in the column of Drew Pearson, whose reporter, David Carr, was a competent KGB source, forcing the British Army to withdraw, a move that would have delivered Greece to the Kremlin had not the U.S. intervened. According to Ralph De Toledano, Deputy Assistant Secretary of State J. Anthony Panuk, in charge of security, tracked down the source of the leak. He discovered that Alger Hiss had asked the Pentagon for this information, though it had nothing to do with his work as director of the Office of Special Political Affairs. For his diligence, Panuk would be forced out of the State Department by Undersecretary of State Dean Acheson. So we see Dean Acheson's in on the whole Alger Hiss thing, right?
It seems that way.
Well, this J. Anthony Panuk, he revealed the spy, and he's the one that lost his job.
That's all just a coincidence, Bill. He lost his job for reasons unknown.
That's just incredible. And the media and the rest of the government lets this go on.
Well, isn't that what we have today? A police officer arrests a criminal, and the police officer goes to jail.
Right. State Department security officers discovered that Hiss's desk calendar for September 14, 1946, recorded a meeting Hiss did not schedule through the department and for which he made no official record with McLean, British Embassy. Donald McLean was a diplomat at the British Embassy in Washington who was also a Soviet agent and a member of the Cambridge spy ring. He would defect in 1951 to the Soviet Union, where he would be rewarded with the rank of colonel in the KGB. Another member of that ring, Kim Philby, famous spy name, would likewise defect to Moscow, later writing in his memoir, it was also the era of Hiss, Cohen, Fox, Gold, Greenglass, and the brave Rosenbergs, not to mention others who are still nameless. That year, over strenuous objections on national security grounds from State Department's Office of American Republics Affairs and the Government of Panama, the U.S. government reported to the United Nations on the Panama Canal Zone as occupied territory, which was a propaganda coup for the Soviets. According to Assistant Secretary of State for Latin American Affairs, Spruill Braden, quote, "We then tried to run it down, and we found that this report had been submitted, and the employment of the words occupied territory by the Office of Special Political Affairs, that is to say, Mr. Alger Hiss." So we had Alger Hiss having designated the Panama Canal Zone as occupied territory
in
the United Nations.
Did he ever designate Israel as occupied territory?
I'm sure he didn't. Secretary of State James Burns told the FBI he would have fired Hiss, but for the mandatory Civil Service Commission hearing, which would have revealed confidential sources on the case. Well, so what? You're just going to let this guy operate in government because you don't want one of your little snitches exposed? In November 1946, the Bureau disseminated to the State Department, Attorney General, and Truman White House yet another secret report, this time reporting Bentley's allegations regarding Eugene Hiss, remember she had his first name wrong, suggesting that this might actually be a reference to Alger Hiss. Hoover asked President Truman for permission to take action against Hiss, Since when does the FBI need permission to enforce the law? That's incredible. But Truman, according to former CIA, according to the former chief of CIA Soviet bloc counterintelligence, Truman remained stubbornly antagonistic to the allegations. In other words, Truman is defending his.
That well, why wouldn't he? Truman is, isn't his middle name Solomon? Although he said it just meant S, that there was no name.
It's very likely Truman was a communist, too. I believe he probably was. But they called him Give Him Hell Harry, and that's exactly what he gave us. He gave us hell, right? That month, for the first time since the elections of 1928, the Republicans had won control of both houses of Congress and a campaign charging Democrats with being soft on communism. I would say they weren't soft on communism. They were fired up with communism. More than one congressman reported the Christian Science Monitor, whenever the subject of leftist activity in the State Department is mentioned, pulled out a list of suspects that was invariably headed by Mr. Hiss. This congressional interest finally forced the Democratic Truman administration to act. The State Department removed Hiss from access to secrets. This is a joke, right? They removed him from access to secrets. We're not going to tell you any more secrets because we think you've been a bad boy. While Justice Department planned a grand jury to look into Soviet espionage, and the truth is that Hiss was never tried for espionage because they delayed it until the statute of limitations was up. Well, why is the statute of limitations for some petty crimes that you see in the street like assault and rape, why are they, the statute of limitations for them, for those crimes, much longer than the statute of limitations for espionage? Why is that only 3 years?
Otherwise, there'd be a lot of Jews in prison.
Yeah, right. The prisons would be lined with Jews if that was more than 3 years. Exactly. In January 1947, Burns quietly eased Hiss out of the State Department. Burns would later refuse to testify as a character witness on behalf of Hiss. Hiss became president at $20,000 a year. That's big bucks back in 1947, right? The equivalent of more than $190,000 a year. Today, it's probably $380,000 a year today. This article is a few years old.
He was doing pretty well for himself.
Right. Hiss became president at $20,000 a year of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. So that reveals to us who they are, right? Serving also as a trustee of the closely related Institute of Pacific Relations so that he could, you know, further drive the knife into China's back, I guess, which would later be identified by the Senate Judiciary Committee as a vehicle by which the communists used to orientate American Far Eastern policies toward communist objectives. He loses his job because he's a spy, and the people that hire him, well, they must be communists. There's no doubt.
But well, why would you hire a former spy?
Right. A well-known one. I mean, whistles were blowing all over the place that Aldo Hiss was a Soviet agent. And it took years. It took years for somebody to finally act on it. It's incredible.
Everybody except for the American public knew he was a spy.
Well, because the Jewish media continued to cover for him, and they're still covering for Alger Hiss. And there shouldn't even be a debate. They should be hung as well as Alger Hiss. If you're singing his praises, if you're defending the man, then you're a communist too. You've exposed yourself. And we as a people don't act on these things. Everything gets swept under the rug and forgotten about because we have beer in a refrigerator and a movie on television, supplied by the same Jews, of course.
Well, if they want communism, they'll get communism.
Well, what was complacency we were told by the founders of this nation that the liberty required eternal vigilance.
So rather, we should say if they don't care what they get, then they're going to get something that they're not going to like.
Well, we get the government. We deserve a sinful people. A sinful people deserves a tyrannical government. I mean, we're told that right in the scripture, right?
If the watchman's asleep at the switch, the thief is having a field day.
Okay, well, that's probably enough for this week, and maybe we'll wrap this up next week. I don't know. I can't guarantee it, but
okay.
It would.
Well, great. I will see you next week then. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Praise Yahweh.